Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A little later in this broadcast, we'll be talking about a new St. Louis public radio project seeking to identify issues important to our community. It's designed to both solicit discussion and to invite action to address them, and you will be the star. One of those issues is race, and we begin today with the myth of race, the troubling persistence of an unscientific idea. That's the title of a book written by Washington University physical anthropology professor Robert Wald-Sussman. He joins me in studio. Professor, nice to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
You know, I think a lot of people are taken aback just by the very title of your book. I think we've been conditioned to believe that the world is comprised of different races.
Yes, we're taught to believe that, and in fact, the world is very racist because of our culture, but not because of biology. Biology shows us that there are no real races in the world. Humans are just humans, basically.
Well, how did we come to believe then, assuming that you are correct in all of this, that there are different races?
Well, I think it started with financial difficulties in different places. And the one that I start with is in the Spanish Inquisition, when people thought that Jews, Gypsies, and other non-Christians were actually making roads into the economic establishment, and they were no longer able to cross over or become crusados, and then they were identified as a race in Europe.
Identified as inferior somehow. I take that from what I've read of your book, that inferiority, the notion of inferiority, played a role.
That's right. They actually had to present purity of blood certificates to show that they didn't have a Christian within their races for the last eight generations. And if they did, they weren't allowed to go into other professions, to colleges, to different things within society.
And this is something that's persisted almost everywhere, I guess, since the Inquisition and perhaps even before, but certainly through the 20th and this part of the 21st century.
That's right. You can follow the actual process of race and how we identify races through the Spanish Inquisition into the colonization, period of colonizations within the United States.
Well, how do we identify races then, aside from this notion of inferiority that we just mentioned?
Well, it's interesting because when they first started to identify different races, they were identified by being either polygenetic or monogenetic. And what that meant that the polygenetic people were actually not created by God, the people who were there were many different groups, and those groups that were here before the Western Europeans were thought of as created before Adam, before God created man, and they had put the earth in bad shape. The monogenism people thought that people were all created by God, but the ones that were further away from Europe were degenerate, and they'd have to be missionized or civilized or educated, and then they could be improved.
So there's a large religious component to this whole way of thinking.
The beginning of racism in Europe and America started with religion, yes.
All right. Well, this is a big subject and a big book, and there's a lot of history involved here. Can you kind of give me the Cliff Notes version of how it evolved from the Spanish Inquisition? I'd like to get it up through the 19th and more specifically the 20th century.
Sure. It started, as I said, with the separation of especially the Africans and the Native Americans into these two different groups. And the people who were the people who thought that environment couldn't change people, those who thought that races were developed before God created man, they basically kept this idea going until the 19th century. And this was kept going by very important politicians in the United States and in Europe. For example, it started with David Hume and moved to Immanuel Kant. Mm-hmm. And it was both of those people were very racist. And on the other side, those were the polygenic people. The monogenic people were the ones like Blumenbach and some of the old philosophers like Buffon and people like that, great biologists and great philosophers. And they basically thought that people were developed by God but had degenerated. Now, that actually was translated from these early philosophers right up into the 18th century when we had Dr. Samuel Morton and what was called the Mortonites, who actually carried this idea of polygenism right up into the 18th century and thought that people, slaves and blacks, were basically developed by people before or somebody before God, and they were not modern. And then Lamarck thought that people were created by God, and they were, again, transferable, or you could missionize them.
There is a chilling word that keeps coming up throughout this history, and that is that the people were referred to as subhuman. And that's most chilling, I guess, for those of us in the modern times, given what happened during Hitler's Third Reich.
That's right.
And the way that's how he referred to the Jews.
Yes. In fact, the people who were in this group that thought many people were not born before Adam thought that any other animal besides humans, and this was Western European humans, were subhuman, were not human, could be treated like other animals, essentially. And in fact, when we got to the 19th century, there was a guy named August Weismann and also another person who transferred – well, Lamarck and Mendel actually were – well, it should be Mendel and Weismann really disproved Lamarck. And so at that point, at the 1900s, actually it was thought that everybody was not created the same. In this case, with Mendel and with Darwinism, they transferred this idea of polygenism into a genetic idea. So now you didn't have to be born by God or not. Even if you were born by God, part of your genes were different. And once they started, you couldn't change them after you went in the right direction. So at that point, the American Eugenics Society was formed. And everybody was thought to be part of this history of genetic development.
Selective breeding.
Selective breeding. And yeah. American genetics, American eugenics went into the idea of selective breeding, importation rules, all of these ideas that were actually carried out by the American eugenicists and carried right into Nazi Germany. Hitler basically used one of the books of the American eugenicists by a guy named Madison Grant, called The Passing of the Great Race, as his Bible for Mein Kampf. So actually, the American Eugenics Association led right to Hitler and Nazism.
I think a lot of people, I recall that from the book, and I was quite taken aback by the fact that we, as a society, might have, and did apparently contribute to Hitler's whole school of thought and frame of reference at the time.
It's very interesting because at first it was written by a guy named Gobineau in France who wrote this idea about eugenics and eugenics. But it was picked up mostly by Americans, by this guy, a guy named Josiah Nott during the slavery. And that was picked up by Harvard University, and that was actually the force of the American eugenics movement by a guy named Charles Davenport, who graduated from Harvard.
And there are plenty of disciples in this country. There are plenty of people who bought into this whole idea.
Well, of course, during the Nazi revolution or the Nazi movement and American eugenics movement, many Americans were caught up in this. And it was only because of the rise of physical anthropology in America that this was sort of balanced or changed. But during the American eugenics movement, which lasted, I think, between 1910 and 1940, a lot of people were American eugenicists. And now after that, the Frontier Fund actually funds people who believe the same thing right now. And they carry on directly from American eugenics, Nazism, to American racism today.
So just to put it in a couple of words, what you're talking about is not – race is not a biological reality. It is a cultural reality. Is
exactly.
That correct?
Exactly.
What does it mean?
Well, it means that we can divide the continent and our nation into different races no matter what we think and no matter what people think. We can just divide it any way we want, and that's what people do. If they don't like Browns now, people coming in from South America, that's a race. If they don't like blacks staying in America, that's a race. And the people who are racist just divide it that way.
So you are really connecting the dots between what is going on in so many communities, including our own, I might add, with regard to racial questions that have arisen, but also with the anti-immigration movement that's taking place in the country today.
It's very, very true that now the Frontier Fund and all the people they fund, many of the people they fund, are now moving towards anti-integration. And now it's not for the blacks coming in from Africa or for Jews coming in from Asia, but it's from or Jews coming in from Germany or any of those places. But now it's the Browns coming in from South America and Mexico.
Well, if there are no races, what then is racism?
Well, racism is what we've been taught. We've been taught to look at the world and look at how we live and categorize different people in different ways. And that's the thing that's taught to us by our schools, by our churches, by the radio. Everything we look at is related to, in some ways, race.
How, given the long history and the predisposition of people to believe that there are distinct races, how do we change that, I wonder?
That's a big question and a difficult question. It's something that I've been working on for many, many years, teaching anthropology at Washington University. And I think, in fact, overall, we're actually winning that race. I mean, you look 20 years ago, there'd be many more racist behavior. And if we looked 40 or 50 years ago, you'd never think that today there'd be a black president. So I think we've changed a great deal, but I think that change that we've had has been very slow. And in fact, as we move ahead, we get a black president, we get more of the racism coming back. So I think we make two steps ahead, go one step back, two steps ahead, one step back.
Well, and on the basis of your study of the history, are you optimistic that we're taking steps forward at this juncture?
I feel that we are moving ahead, and I've said that in the book. I think there have been great steps that we've made in equalizing both race and things like racial tensions and sex tensions and those things. And we've moved in our legislature and generally ahead. But sometimes when you look at some of the political things going on today, you think we're not moving ahead so quickly.
Yeah, I think a lot of people probably would fall into that camp at this particular juncture in any case. My guest in studio is Robert Wald Sussman of Washington University. He is the author of The Myth of Race, The Troubling Persistence of an Unscientific Idea. We'll take a break now, come back and continue our conversation with Professor Sussman in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Professor Sussman. Professor, off the air, you had indicated that there are a number of critics who have emerged as a result of what you've written. Who are they and what are they saying?
Well, what happened is Harvard University allowed one of the blogs on email to put out part of a section of my book, a chapter on the American Renaissance group who puts out a magazine every week or every 2 weeks. And it's a right-wing, racist organization. And the editor of that, or the founder of that, a guy named Taylor, actually threatened to sue me. And he also told the people reading the magazine to send in reviews of the book on Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. So now if you look at the reviews at Amazon.com, we have half of the reviews very good, 5, and half the reviews 0, you know, sort of saying that they've never read the book, but they'd never read a book like this anyway. Huh. And those comments sound like these people came right out of the 16th and 17th century.
Well, what got you into this?
Into writing the book?
Yeah, into this whole subject.
Well, it's interesting because I started working in sociology as a graduate student and switched over to anthropology because I thought I'd learn more about racism. And one of the reasons I went into physical anthropology was to study about racism. But this was in the 60s. And at that time, racism was sort of, I thought, was answered, and that people saw that there was no real biological racism. Mm-hmm. So I pulled away from it and I became a primatologist. But throughout the years in teaching physical anthropology, I've been teaching racism, and racism from the beginning when I started studying it in the 70s. So a lot of my background is from a study of the history of racism from its beginnings.
We have a couple of calls I want to take. I'll repeat that number, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK if you want to get into the conversation. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or you can send us a tweet at STL on air. I was just looking in my notes here for a term that you use. I can't find it. I'll come up with it in just a moment. It's scientific racism, I guess, is what
yes.
I was.
Uh-huh.
That I gather from what I've read is basically scientists who basically accept the notion that there are different races.
That's right, and it started with the Frontier Fund, which actually looked for scientists who were talking about race and actually then grabbed those people and had them become very important scientists over the radio and television and media.
What would the mix be, do you think, those who would support your thesis and those who don't?
In science?
Yeah.
Well, in science, biologists, geneticists, physical anthropologists, 90 to 95% believe exactly the way I do, that there are no races and that this is a biological phenomenon, and they teach it all the time. And I think this is actually making a difference in the education of college students. However, there are a number of other scientists, many of which I have in the book, who actually speak about race, but they've never studied anything about race. They're physicists and chemists and things like that.
In terms of definition, what would determine a race?
Well, actually, racism is very interesting because it's really talking about subspecies in mammals, mm-hmm. and there are real subspecies in mammals. So if we look at some mammals who separated a long time ago, became separated and didn't interbreed over time, they would become racist. And different ones of those animals would be further and further away from the original and closer to a new race. So, you know, that's how we form. We form by subspecies becoming races and then species over time.
They would become different, but how? Would they become different in appearance? Would they physiologically, would they be different? How would they be different?
Well, they would have differences that were related to the environment, and those differences would show up in genetics. And it isn't until the genetics change enough that they couldn't interbreed. And once they couldn't interbreed, they'd be new species. And some new species look very much the same. So they haven't changed that much physiologically, but they've changed genetically. But other species have a lot of differences, but still can interbreed other intergroup species. So if you look at the development of mammals, you can see certain mammals that really do have races. Chimpanzees have races, actually. The groups are different enough, and they've been separated enough for long enough to actually develop races. In humans, if you look at their history, they don't grade by dividing up and not integrating. What they do is they divide up and then reintegrate. So throughout their evolution, they've been splitting and then coming back together. So they've always been an integration of the races throughout time. We've never been split enough to actually develop into new races.
You know, one of the things you hear,
heard
often during some of the confrontation in our racial history, if you will, is people who will say, if you I hate to say this around lunchtime, but if you perform an autopsy on a black man and a white man and a white woman, Asian, you name it, they all look the same inside. They're all built exactly the same. Just the color of their skin is different.
That's very true. There might be some slight differences because of specific areas that people were brought up in. But generally, they look the same. There's hardly any difference. And genetically, they're the same. In fact, there's so little differences genetically that there's more similarities between groups than there are differences between groups.
All right. We have an email here from Tara who writes, does the constant use of the terms black and white, especially by the reporting media, create misunderstanding and distrust, as in the events of Ferguson?
I think it does, and I think we constantly sort of look at the news almost as if it's color formed. And I think that's probably a problem, that we should probably talk about people in general and not break it up into races, because even then, black and white aren't the only two races or only two groups that people divide people into.
You almost called them races.
Well,
I mean, that's how we talk.
That's how we talk, and that's the way we still would talk, even though we have to know that we're not talking about biological differences.
All right. Let's take some calls now, and while we're on this part of the discussion, we'll bring in Jeff calling from St. Louis. Jeff, thanks for waiting.
Thank you, Don. Yeah, this is really important to me, and I've been struggling with it. I hear people recently who recognize, they acknowledge and write intelligently about the myth of race and how it got invented in the 18th century, And yet they still use language that reinforces the assumptions, the cultural, you know, categories. And to my surprise, Professor Sussman, I'm very impressed with everything you said, but I just, you know, heard you talk about our black president, and it's that kind of language. I think it's race talk that keeps us trapped in race thinking, and I don't think that we're going to get out of, you know, this kind of tribalism until we can change that language.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
I would agree with that, and I do make that mistake, and it's what we're sort of biologically and socially learned to do. But I think you're right. We have to get out of that kind of talking.
That's part of what you say in the book, and that is that until people join the tribe that Jeff alluded to, these newcomers who come in, until they join the tribe, they're considered different and often called a different race.
Right.
Right. Let's bring in Dennis, calling from University City. Dennis, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Don, you are fabulous, and your guest is right on target. And I have read about eugenics origin in the United States. And also, IBM was one of Hitler's greatest friends in the 30s, finding ways to snatch up the Jews. And race, I think, is a tool of divide and conquer, and people are manipulated in order to fear one another. And let's say the Irish sold into slavery in the Caribbean. When the British ran out of the Irish, then in came the Africans. And then later on, divide the Irish and the Africans so they don't unite and overthrow slavery. So definitely the only thing I know that's racially valid is lactose intolerance. I can walk across the street to Washington U, or rather across the hill, and I am just so impressed and so proud of having an author of this wonderful caliber working across the hill from me. Thank you so much for being on the air.
Well, thank you, and your views about IBM are very true. It's one of the people who started classifying races with Halloran cards many years ago.
IBM. Let's take another call. Dan in Kirkwood, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting what the professor had to say. Now, he may have already answered this question, but some of the reading I've done indicates that as a species, we almost went extinct about 50 to 70,000 years ago, and there was a few of us left in between maybe estimates from 800 to 8,000 left in Northeast Africa, and there's various theories about that, and that so if that's the case, we couldn't possibly have evolved into a different species in this time. Is that information I've been reading correct?
I think it is correct. Also, it's interesting that Homo sapiens, our species, has only been around for 200,000 years ago, which is not very long.
Yeah.
And we evolved from Africa, and then, as I said, we sort of constantly interacted back and forth to and from Africa. So we were never isolated.
One more question, if I might, real quick.
I'm sure.
Time, but this is sort of unrelated. One of my heroes is David Hume. I didn't realize he was a racist, but that's happened before. He's kind of a hero of the Enlightenment to me. What was his racist about his thought?
Well, basically, he told David Hume and actually wrote that we'd never find civilization in anything outside of the Western Europeans.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Right.
Isn't racism just a convenient way, and I hesitate to use that word, a convenient way to kind of categorize people that are different from us or that we don't like?
I think that's why I started with the Spanish Inquisition, because that's when people started dividing people into us and them, and that was based on economic reasons. And if we look through our history, we find many of the ways in which we divide up other people is because of economic and social reasons and not because of anything to do with racism. That's why the Irish were called race at a certain time.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, if we call those people subhuman, it just makes it easier to get the mob excited about putting them at a distance.
Well, I think the term subhuman really implies that they're environmentally unchangeable, because then they can't become human no matter what you do. So then you just put them on the outside.
Let's take another call. We'll bring in Jeff. Jeff, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm one of a large group. There's a large group of people around the city recently that have been having courageous conversations about racism, and for the purposes of these discussions, they're defining racism as privilege plus power. And I would like to hear what your opinion is of that definition.
Well, I think you could put it in that category of people who are, let's say, scientific racists right now, are people who believe that they are in political power. And in many cases, they have power. So I do think in some cases you're actually right that you could actually divide people in that way.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you very much.
Jeff, thank you for the call. The issue that we're talking about here, kind of around it, is one of control, as I see it. And that is that using this classification is a way for one group to control another. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, very much so. And if you look at the immigration laws being passed now, you know, the new laws that have been written in Arizona and those laws, they are actually to control whites against Brown's coming up from South America and Central America and Mexico. And those are things, a way in which we can control our environment in some ways.
How was the argument made 150 years ago during the height of slavery in this country?
Well, that was really basically a polygenic versus monogenic idea that many of these people were degenerate or born outside of God and that they were subhuman in many ways, either by their upbringing or by the way they were born.
In your book, in the early part of your book, you spent some time talking about migration and the role that migration played in all this. Why don't you just articulate that for us?
Well, it's interesting because early in times, before we had boats that took people from one country to another, people actually migrated short distances. So there wasn't that much great difference between people. So they didn't see these major differences in race. And it was actually in colonialism taking on this idea of the sort of Spanish Inquisition to colonial times when people went to Africa and America, where you find big differences in the way people see the way people actually are colored and behave.
So this whole process, can we say, was used as a justification for colonialism?
It was a justification for the way we acted out colonialism, yes. Mm-hmm. And it allowed us to actually subjugate the Africans and the American Indians.
You mentioned the Spanish Inquisition earlier. The rest of Europe was not guiltless or blameless in this whole process, not very receptive to outsiders.
No, it was very, very similar to – in fact, the Spanish Inquisition really moved very quickly through Spain and to other countries, and they did the same thing to, again, Jews, gypsies, and things like that. And you can see that in the Spanish Inquisition. You can see it come back in Nazism, the same kind of – in fact, during Nazism, it was the Jews that were the problem, whereas in America, it's always been the blacks that are the problem.
And, of course, it was the progeny of the people from the Spanish Inquisition era that came and settled in this country.
They were the first conquistadores here in United States.
And, of course, they thought the Native Americans were subhuman.
Exactly.
Let's take another call. Lori in Edwardsville, it's your turn. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just was making a comment that I find it interesting that young children up to a certain age, usually upper grade school age, seem to be colorblind.
That's exactly true. And if you keep them well-trained and give them good background, they'll stay that way. Your children can be colorblind up till age unknown if you keep them that way. What I'm saying is that racism is an educatable phenomenon.
That's right. Yes, I agree. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Lori, for the call. I think of the Broadway show South Pacific, Rodgers and Hammerstein, and the famous song "You've Got to Be Taught to Hate." Most of us start all of this this journey that we're on with a pretty clean slate. It's the fact that those around us, that's part of the environment you're talking about.
That's it. I mean, it's our cultural background that teaches us what we learn when we're older, but you can actually change that with good education.
Well, where should we be taking this now? Professor, you've spent a lot of time, done a lot of research in putting all this together. I have to say, forgive me for saying this, most people aren't going to read your book. It's dense, it's heavy, and it's well researched, but it's very professorial. A lot of people aren't going to read it. Where do we take it?
Well, I think that education is one way. My work at university is this almost all the time, and other kinds of communication, radio communication, television communication. We have to keep teaching people that people are people, and they're not one race or another.
One of the callers earlier referred to the role of the media. How do you see the media's role in all of this, not only in the future, but actually to this point, the role it's played getting us where we are today?
Well, I think the media has been both good and bad on this situation. In many cases, media is racist. In many cases, they're not racist. One of the things I find wrong with the media and sort of educational phenomena on the media is the fact that, like the news every day, I look at often the way we look at the world is the 5 o'clock news view of the world.
That's a whole other subject, isn't
right.
it? Professor Robert Wall Sussman of Washington University, author of the book, The Myth of Race, The Troubling Persistence of an Unscientific Idea. Thank you so much for being with us, and good luck with the book.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about a new St. Louis Public Radio project.